welcome to the Game Theory Podcast. I'm your host, Sam Vecini. We are presented by The Athletic today on the show. Mark Schindler is in the building. We're going to talk about Game 3 of the NBA Finals, where the Denver Nuggets beat the Miami Heat. We're going to talk Chris Paul maybe potentially sort of being waived, depending on whose report you read, who's to say. We're going to talk a little bit about the 2023 NBA draft, some news and notes. I made assurances on the last show that I would talk to you about some promises and the concept of promises in the NBA draft and why I think they're silly and absurd in a lot of different directions. We will talk about those. And I don't know, we'll talk about anything. Like I have a possum or like a rat in my roof right now, Mark. Like this is where we're at in my life. I finished the draft guide. And in the middle of finishing the draft guide last week, we think that some sort of possum slash rat moved into our roof.
Yeah. I am unhappy for you because that sounds awful. And I would not want to deal with that at all. I'm like kind of a, I wouldn't consider myself a full meat freak, but like I really don't handle messiness well. So like the potential of a rodent or insect or anything like that. Like, I mean, like I can handle like an ant or something, but if it's something bigger than an ant, I'm like ready to burn my house down. So yeah. I can only imagine what you are going through right now.
Well, so this is part of the bargain of moving to Australia, right? You get the wildlife and
yeah, fuck no.
We can just randomly hear scratching at times, like in the roof. It tends to start around like 3 or 4, which by the way, it's like 2 o'clock here. So if we go long enough, we might start to hear it. And we've researched on how to get rid of this thing, right? And what we have found is that essentially wildlife laws in Australia, if it is a possum, we actually like can't just kill it. Like that's not a thing we can do. We have to safely get it out of the roof. And then we also have to let it loose on our property again in order for it to find like a safe haven. Because if you release them in the wild, I guess they've done studies that say that they will die within like 2 weeks or something. And we don't want possums dying, I guess. So essentially, this possum now lives on our property. It can choose to leave at any point, but based off of like wildlife laws, as my wife and I understand them here in Australia, we may not be able to rid ourselves of this possum.
Wow. See, that's such a conundrum. Because it's like, dog, his safe haven is your house. So where do you think he's going to go after you release him back on your property?
Well, we have to like close up like the hole if we can find the hole, and that's like a whole other
thing. Yeah, but exactly like what,
right?
They can. I don't know how.
No idea what
in the first place. How do I know if it's
no idea how it's getting in? Like the reason we think it's a possum is that there was a possum living like in our shrubs, and it was like a baby possum. It was fine. Like we didn't really care that it was in the shrubs. It's all good. We're not gonna like remove it or anything. But we think because it's winter here now, as opposed to summer over in the United States, we think it's moved in to try and get warmth. And then like, we'll wake up at night and go scavenge and then come back and continue to have the warmth. So yeah, we might just have like a possum friend in our house at this point. We might just have to move. Like that might be a thing. Like just sell this house, you know, make sure all the showings are in the afternoon and then, you know, move somewhere else. That's a possible outcome, right?
Yeah, just move back to America and not in the South.
Oh, my God. Okay, let's talk about Denver and Miami Game 3. This game finished with a final score of 109-94 in favor of the Denver Nuggets, who go up 2-1 in the NBA Finals. This game was dominated by Jamal Murray and Nikola Jokic. You best believe that we're doing some tape breakdowns on the two-man game between Jamal Murray and Nikola Jokic later on in this show. A completely dominant performance, a game that once we got into the second quarter and like midway through the second quarter, it felt like Denver took a stranglehold of this game and just like never was going to let go. And I'm going to be honest, I'll be a little bit, you know, vulnerable. I'm struggling with this series to care about. Like, I care about it, but I'm struggling with, like, staying engaged with it at a really high level, because we'll talk about, like, all the X's and O's and stuff. We'll talk about things when we're breaking down the two-man game and everything between Jokic and Murray. The problem that I'm struggling with is that Denver is just a lot better than this team. Just, like, genuinely. They are a lot better than the Miami Heat. And the ways that they're better make it so it is exceptionally difficult, in my opinion, for Miami to overcome it in a seven-game series. So I think that the way for me to phrase it is, like, I'm interested but struggling to stay, like, fully engaged in it. Does that sound fair in some way?
I get what you're saying. That's fine. I think I've enjoyed it. Not that you haven't enjoyed it, but I think I've gotten a little bit more out of it. But yeah. I agree with you. I think tonight was that felt a lot farther apart than 15 points.
And game one felt a lot farther apart than, like, 11 or whatever it finished.
Yeah. I agree with that for sure. And I think, you know, I'm hopeful that Miami can try and muck some things up. But I thought Denver came in and just generally everything that they kind of got away from in the second half of game two, they course corrected in this game. And I felt like they got really back to a lot of the roots and what works for them. Miami wasn't able to take them out of it. And then on the other end, they took Miami out of anything that they wanted. So it was, there's a lot to dive into with this one.
The first place I want to dive into, because we're going to dive deeper into Jokic and Murray here momentarily, is the Christian Brown of it all. Were you a Christian Brown fan last year in the 2022 NBA draft?
I was a very big fan of Christian Brown.
Yep.
If I remember correctly, and I'm not saying that this is how it played out. Obviously, he ended up getting a little bit more playing time down the stretch, but, like, I think there was a portion that I think I ended up with Ochai higher, but there was a portion of last season where I was like, yeah, I think Christian could end up the better prospect or better player in the pros. And I'm not saying that's what's happening out now. Point being, like, I was very in on Christian Brown. I really liked him. I really liked everything that he brought to the game. And I think a lot of that has – I mean, we saw him that play out tonight. Like, I mean, this was one of the games where you're like, yeah, that's what Christian Brown does. So, yes, I was a big fan of him. And I've enjoyed a lot of what he's brought just in general this season, but especially tonight.
I was too. And I think we're seeing a lot of why I was a fan. I had Ochai at 19 and I had Christian at 23. So I had them, like, basically, like, dead even as prospects. I guess, like, I gave a little slight nod toward Ochai.
Yeah, I just played Ochai a little bit more because more track record as a shooter. So,
but it's the functional athleticism of Christian Brown that I think is interesting, in addition to just being, like, fiery, tough. Like, that dude, he hasn't done it a ton in the NBA yet. But that dude talks shit all the time in college.
He certainly looks like it.
Like, that dude is so confident every single time he takes the court. Has very real, like, vertical pop, has very, especially off 2 feet. Like, you give him any sort of ability to load up off 2 feet, he's going to throw down violently and thunderously. He's also, as much as anything, an awesome team defender. Like, you watch the way he closes out onto shooters. You watch the way that, like, he's able to stay on balance, get his hands high at 6'6", 6'7", while also being able to cut off drives. Like, that is what stood out to me more than anything at Kansas, is he was going to be an awesome scramble defender in the NBA. And that's a thing as an evaluator that I'm looking for more and more, is the ability to scramble on balance at size with athleticism, defensively within team concepts. I think that that is maybe the most important thing you can do as a defender in today's NBA at this point, is as a team defender, be able to scramble around, be switchable, be able to hold up on different assignments, be able to close out on balance, be able to process quickly all of this in terms of what's happening around you at once, and then be able to make an impact. It's hard. It's a lot harder than what people think it is. Like, people think that defense is all tools, you know, or some people think that, oh, if you just try hard, you can be good on defense. It's not the way this works. It's not the way defense works at all in the NBA. You need to have real genuine physical tools. You need to have real genuine athleticism. You have to have balance at a really high level defensively. You need to have size, and you need to play with real aggression. Like, aggression is a prerequisite, but it's not a be-all, end-all, I think. And that's what Christian brings. And he was great tonight in transition. I thought he was one of the best transition players in last year's NBA draft. Like, he's a great cutter. He just knows where to be. He's a winner. Like, you can go too simply by distilling guys down into the word winner. But I think with Christian, it just kind of fits, right?
Yeah. I mean, like you're hitting on, I think especially for this team, like, part of why I love the fit for him in the draft, and I think that played out a lot this year, is just he fits so much of what they need in their offense around Jamal Murray and Nikola Jokic, with somebody who is, when he does get opportunities, he's going to take them. I think, like, part of the reason I was maybe a little bit lower on him was because of some three-point hesitancy, but I don't really think that was a thing that was an issue for him his rookie season at all. There were a lot of times where he'd, like, pass up open threes or wait too long at Kansas, but that, you know, I don't think that's been an issue for him as a rookie. But point being, like, when he gets an opportunity to attack off the catch, he's going. Like you mentioned too, like, he just notices things quickly. He picks up things quickly. He's really good at attacking in the flow. And I think, like, pretty much all of his points tonight are coming off that. Like, it's not having to do anything crazy. It's just Jamal Murray and Nikola Jokic were damn near unstoppable tonight. I honestly think Miami guarded them about as well as I could have asked of them. That was just, they hit really good shots. And based on how the coverage was going, I thought when you have somebody like Christian who came in and was able to bring what he brought, given what some of the guys ahead of him weren't, that's just how you get punished. That was really hard for them to handle.
Yeah. No, it's funny. Like, I track the guys that I tend to be higher on than anybody else in the public sphere pre-draft. And Christian was one of them last year that I was higher on, from a ranking perspective, like a pure number perspective, than anybody else. And I feel great about it. Like, I feel awesome about Christian Brown being really good. Now, I'm sure that there are guys last year that, you know, I think I had Jake LaRavia higher than everybody else did. And, you know, Jake barely played this year. So we'll see if that continues long term. But, you know, I'm not going to get them all right. But it was a very real, I felt very good about Christian Brown for all of the exact reasons that we have seen thus far in this game. And by the way, to kind of pigeonhole this into the 2023 NBA draft, you better believe that I got multiple text messages tonight from agents that are representing players that are like, oh man, like, we're trying to sell our guy as, like, the next Christian Brown, because it's very in front of NBA evaluators' minds right now watching the finals. They have this guy that's athletic, that can process the game, that can play defensively, that can play a lot of different roles, right? You better believe that Christian Brown's going to be a popular name over the course of the next, you know, 2 weeks for agents when they get in front of NBA teams talking about what kind of impact their player can make. And I think that's a testament to Christian Brown.
Most definitely. Just to address the comment too, JJ points out that Christian was a little bit hesitant in the Lakers series, and I totally agree with that. That was an issue. I just mean during the regular season. I didn't feel that was a problem. I think that was definitely present in the Lakers series. I should have highlighted that, but yeah.
Okay. Let's now talk about the Jokic Jamal Murray two-man game, because my goodness, I mean, that thing was just absolutely unbelievable tonight. I didn't even grab all the clips that I could have. It was incredible. But more than anything, I'll just ask you, what stood out to you above all within watching Jokic and Murray dominate this game? Because they did. That is the biggest reason that Denver won.
Yeah, I mean, I thought Miami kind of came out swinging a little bit, trying to really shut things down defensively. And I thought they were doing a really good job staying attached and just making things difficult. But Jamal having the kind of heater that he did in the first quarter and just early on in the game was monumental for getting that offense going. Because, I mean, the offense did not look good to start the game. Like, they were kind of a little bit in the mud at points. And overall, I was like, not worried, but I was just kind of like, okay, what is this going to look like? We're not getting the Michael Porter Jr. game I was hoping for. I'm at the point, I just don't think that's going to happen this series, even with, you know, as well as Denver is playing. And again, Jamal just like, I mean, it's a couple of like off the dribble running off screens while contested. And it's just, those are the kind of fuck you shots that you can't really, like, what do you do about them when somebody's able to hit those? And then I think once that starts happening, and then you get, I still think trapping Jamal Murray is like a terrible idea, because cool, give it to Nicole. I'm sure you saw my tweets. Give it to Nikola Jokic with a 4-on-3. And like, yeah. I on one hand, like, I get wanting to throw the kitchen sink out and try everything. And I think the Heat needed to, because I mean, they tried running a zone. Their zone got eviscerated first play that they tried to run it. Shout out to Jeff Green.
You can't zone awesome this Denver baseline team. Screen. I just don't think you can.
Well, I liked the matchup zone that they did last game, but that felt more like that's not something that you can just rely on as a base. Like, I thought that worked for a quarter, but you can't do that for an entire game, because they're going to come with new stuff for this game. And I think that's part of, not that I thought like Miami was dead in the water after game two, but I'm looking ahead to game three, like, I feel pretty good about Denver coming into this one, because Miami just had to throw everything to try and, I mean, not to try, like, to take that game. And I'm not trying to be reductive with it, but I just felt like there were less things where it felt like Miami could really go to something. And to be fair too, if Miami just shoots well from three again, it's a little bit of a different story. But I also think part of that is what they weren't able to get going offensively that caused them to shoot what they did to an extent. But the biggest thing is, like you mentioned, I think once you get both those guys, like once you start having to worry about Jamal in that space, when he's able to put that kind of pressure on your defense, and then it's like, well, how do we guard both of them while shutting off other things? And then it's like, okay, well, now we have Christian Brown. Once you guys have it close, and then we extend the lead because we actually have a guy in the fifth spot who can do something. And then, yeah, I mean, that was just pretty technical from the Nuggets tonight.
Well, I'm glad you brought up the word technical, because I think the things that stand out to me most are, first, I think that Miami tried a lot of different coverages and none of them worked. Mm-hmm. And I think that showcases really the problem with defending this action, right? You can do many different things and try many different things. It's just that Jokic in particular is such a nightmare as a mismatch problem in a lot of different potential coverages that you can't really do much with him. He's just unstoppable in a lot of ways. Second, Denver had a lot of very smart little variations that they would run in order to use this action. Like, we're going to show like some interesting, like, double drag slips. We're going to show some Spain pick and roll actions. We're going to show a lot of different, you know, areas of the court where they try to go empty on one side. They'd go middle ball screens. Like, they found so many different technical ways to get into the screening actions and to get into the two-man game that I thought Miami just had no real way to know what was coming. And that unpredictability, I think, is what makes it so difficult a lot of the time. So let's just jump into the tape here. Let's start with the first one. So this is going to be Jokic. He kind of picks the ball up here. Kentavious Caldwell-Pope is like almost trying to come up to set like an empty side ball screen, but instead Jokic picks the ball up. And then watch KCP. He's going to actually just like shoot through here. And by doing that, he sets up an empty side ball screen. This is at 10:30 of the first quarter, right? He's setting up this empty side ball screen where it's just wide open for Jamal Murray. It's so wide open. This is, it looks like, because there was no contact really on the screen, Love just kind of vacated the area and kind of just went to his man thinking that Jimmy would be able to recover back. And I don't know why he did that. Typically this is a situation where you're going to ice a lot of the time, and this isn't an ice. This is just like Love vacating the area. And as KCP was shooting through the play, Gabe Vincent ends up coming over and trying to be the help man as the low man. And like, he's just not big enough. at the end of the day. You can't have Gabe Vincent as the low man.
Yeah, and this is where what's so hard too, because I think, you know, just in basketball in general, like it's been playing out a ton in the W2 this year, but like seeing the way that teams have like pair up, I feel like it goes underrated, like how much, or maybe under noticed slash under talked about, like how much some of these actions get paired up at the same time. Because like you mentioned, like that's just a read. That's not a play. Like that's just KCP. Jokic picks up the ball. They're denying any kind of potential for the screen. He's like, okay, I'm going to cut weak side. So you have to come with me and we're just going to run something here too. And obviously Jokic cuts down the middle too. So you can't really just stand there. It's, when you have so many moving parts at the same time, especially when you have a playmaker like Nikola Jokic, like, okay, well, if we don't pick up the KCP, then he's a 40% 3-point shooter getting the ball in the corner. And if we're closing out to them, I mean, then there's a gap. There's an issue. And like, it's just so hard to make that happen. One of the things I actually would have kind of liked to see tonight, and that I maybe want to see moving forward, that I think this play kind of highlights, I would like to see Miami try and be more physical on pickup points. Because I think that was something they got away from tonight that they were really good at in the second game, was just making it so hard for cutters and just guys in general to get off, because it seems like a small thing, but having your hand on somebody makes it that much harder to actually get a pass off. But yes, I mean, this was a great first clip to bring up with what they were able to get going.
Yeah, just really, really sharp. And you're going to see a lot of the time here, they're going to try and take advantage of Gabe Vincent. That is a real factor that happened in this game. And Gabe Vincent has been great, but Gabe is just a little bit small. And that's always going to be a bit of a difficulty. So this is a finish here. This is the second clip coming up at 9:46 of the first quarter. Jokic dribble handoff to Michael Porter Jr. And then they're going to get right into that handoff comes on the left side of the court. And then Porter reverses it over to the right side of the court for Jamal Murray, where they are immediately getting into a Spain pick and roll action from the side of the court here on the right side. So you're going to see here essentially what happens by doing this is you're going to get Jamal Murray driving, and you're going to get that little momentary confusion between Jimmy Butler and Gabe Vincent, I think. I'm not totally sure that Jimmy Butler knew what exactly they wanted to run here, because he kind of like takes a weird angle around the screen. I think that he thinks that Gabe is going to come over and switch this because he's so far behind the play, and that Jimmy is then going to go over to KCP. He kind of then shoots at the ball as just like a quick little dig, and then he stays high. And now they're in a 3-on-2 situation where either Bam or Kevin Love has to step up once Jamal gets both feet into the paint. And that's just very difficult at that point, right? It's just really, really sharp the way that they utilize all of this movement, all of these actions. And essentially, again, they're isolating Gabe Vincent here in a pretty real way, forcing him to switch or make that dig. And then you're isolating the big here with Bam Adebayo, making him guard 2-on-1.
Can you rewind it one more time really quick? Because there's something I want to explain here too, because this is one of the things where like and this is not me just trying to dog Mark Jackson, but this is where I like lose my mind a little bit with the, oh, just trap Jamal Murray thing. And it's not just Jamal Murray. It's just in general. It is so hard to trap somebody in the middle of the floor. I think like that's what gets lost a lot in
looking. You actually can't do it.
Exactly. Like this is where, what, like, cause I think that's, well, part of what the Nuggets did so well with this, like, okay, yes, like even with them running it from the slot where, like you mentioned earlier, technically you're icing it, the way that they run this play, it's impossible to ice it. And it's impossible to actually try and blitz the ball screen. And it's really difficult to put two on the ball because this happens. Like when you have a team that's, okay, if they wanted to switch a bunch, or when they move to putting Bam in a little bit of a smaller drop, I mean, shorter drop, like, okay, especially with the angle that Jokic is getting off on, if you're switching that, Jimmy's on his back and there's an inside angle on the pass. If you're going over, then Bam is getting put in a really precarious situation. And like, if you do just switch it outright and Bam stays underneath or something, like, okay, then that's really difficult too, because then you're still just making, it's just an incredibly difficult play to guard. Like that's not something that you can just say, yeah, let's put two on the ball and figure it out. Like all of these guys, other than probably MPJ, are really good at swinging the ball, and that's just extremely hard to guard. Like, you can't – again, like, I think this speaks a lot to – it's because they have the personnel to do it, but the Nuggets are so good at least in this game to me, a lot of what stood out is they were really intentional about making it extremely difficult to play the way that Miami wanted to defensively.
Yeah, and, you know, we're going to talk about Miami putting two on the ball later. It was not good in this game. It did not go well for Miami when they put two on the ball. So this next possession here, 9:20 of the first quarter, literally the next possession down the court, Jokic sets this screen and sends up just having to be a peel switch, essentially, because the screen from Jokic is strong enough to where there's just no way for Jimmy to get all the way around it. Maybe he could have, but it just ends up being a peel switch at the end of the day because they're empty on this side of the action. And if he doesn't peel switch it and Bam just doesn't try and stay in front of Jamal Murray here, you're going to end up with Jamal just completely turning the corner every single time on him, given the fact that he's coming around it with a head of steam. Bam does a pretty good job containing the peel switch, I think. Like, I actually did like a very, very good job there. But the problem when you peel switch is then you get Jokic on a small in post-ups. And if Nikola Jokic is on a smaller guy, even Jimmy Butler, who is 6'7" and is strong as shit, he is not Nikola Jokic. And Nikola Jokic is still going to bury him and move him backward to where he wants to go.
Yeah, 100%. And I do think, too, it's kind of – this is not – I'm not trying to say, like, Jimmy doesn't have a dog in him or something. You're playing as freaking Nikola Jokic. But I do think, like, again – the physicality, I do think, was not on point from the Heat tonight. I'd imagine – I'd love to – I need to go watch Bo's postgame after this, but I'd imagine he probably said something about that too.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, Jimmy's defense there at the mesh point was just, like, not good enough at the end of the day. He's coming around late. He's trailing way too far. It is what it is. Jimmy's a great player, but that was not an awesome – defensive rep there, and the previous one was also not a great defensive rep. So here Jamal Murray's coming down. You're going to see again two-man game's going to start, and this time they essentially are playing like a drop here, I guess is what I would call this, right? It's almost like it's not quite a catch drop.
It's probably really more of a show and recover, I would assume. Because, like, I mean, with Jimmy chasing over, the idea is to get him back in front. But because, I mean, Bam's going to recover to Yoke once Jimmy does. But again, with the angle of the screen, the way he slips too, it's hard.
Yeah, totally. And then you just get this slip from Jokic. And Jokic, you know, doesn't – they actually defended this well, I think, by the way. Like, this ends up being, like, kind of a fluky bucket where, you know, bounces off of Jokic and everything, and it works.
And to his credit, too, this is part of what – was different tonight than other nights. I think this was only MPJ's only basket tonight. Jesus Christ.
Yeah. Busket. But, that's correct. Yeah. I believe that's correct terminology.
They were I thought their off ball players were so much better at just moving tonight, because that was something that was not there for a large stretch of game two. Again, like, I thought Miami did a really good job of, like, trying to take away some of the cutting lanes and being active in there. But, once you make it that hard to guard that two-man game and you have guys that are cutting, well.
Or spacing.
Moving. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, even then, like, it's talking about the intentionality. All right, it's not just let's get into two-man game. It's, okay, Jokic sets a flare screen for one of the best shooters on planet Earth, and then – you get into mid game. So you clear out the middle of the floor after forcing the weak side to be guarded, and it makes it incredibly difficult.
Yeah. Next up here, that was at the 6:40 mark of the first quarter. This next one's going to be at the 5:40 mark of the first quarter. This is going to be essentially a slip double drag here, where you're going to bring the ball up the court in transition with Jamal Murray, and you're going to set essentially a double screen in the middle of the court for Jamal to come around from the right side of the court to get into the middle of the court. The reason it's a slip double drag is that the first screener, Aaron Gordon, slips the action and goes to the rim immediately in order to try and pressure the defense that way. So you're going to see here, Gordon leaves before he actually sets the screen, slips it. Next up, you're going to see this little reversed screen now from Jokic after the double drag. And that's just really hard. And this time, again, I think it is like essentially a drop, like, you know, hopefully like a show and recover where Bam is trying to drop and trying to cut off, and then eventually he's going to have to get back into Nikola Jokic's area. And again, just cash. If you end up leaving Jokic away or leaving Jokic alone that far, and A, if you don't get a body on him until he gets to that 15-foot area, you're dead. That's what the reality is. You are genuinely dead every single time. I don't even know what to call. I think it's like a catch drop, kind of, right? Mm-hmm. Like, this is essentially like a catch drop from Bam Adebayo. He's trying to stay high so that Jamal can't just pull up around the screen. Went too far back that time. But I think that he's staying attached to Jamal there too long. And if you do that, again, Jokic is just in the middle of the court and that's it.
I agree, but also, again, like, that's really hard because when you get that slip to start, I it's talking about the intentionality. When it's not just, hey, here's a screen with Jamal and Jokic in the middle of the court. It's, okay, here's Aaron. He slips. And then Jimmy shifts his body because of that. Like, he's, like, again, it's sort of, like, he preps a little bit like he's icing. And then they flip the screen, and it makes it that much harder to get over because his body's in a different angle. So it's, like, again, like, it's some of the pre-work stuff to set up what they do next is what, like, it adds to making it that much. Like, you get just a little bit more extra with that.
Well, and the other piece of it, too, is you notice what happens on the switch is that Gabe Vincent is guarding Jamal Murray here to start the possession, mm-hmm. but he has to switch the slip at the end of the day, which ends up leading to Jimmy Butler. I'm going to be honest. Does it feel like to you that in this first quarter, after a certain point, they started to attack Jimmy Butler on Jamal Murray as a matchup?
I don't think it was about attacking Jimmy Butler necessarily. I think it's like, I think it's less attacking and more just doing whatever they can to get Jamal different kinds of looks, because I think, mm-hmm. I mean, to be fair, like Gabe's been really awesome getting over screens throughout the series.
Yep.
But I think it's more just, okay, well, if we have Gabe Vincent behind us instead of Jimmy, or we just have like just making it, I'm all over the place. But I think, like, again, it's just when you add all those little extra wrinkles in to make it so it's not the exact matchup that you're trying to get, or to try and take them out of the zone of how they want to play. Like, I just think it makes it that much harder. I don't think it's necessarily just a Jimmy thing. I mean, this speaks on Bam too. Like, and this is not to say that Bam did not have it necessarily offensively tonight, but I think in general, like, they haven't really, I mean, clearly they haven't found a coverage they're comfortable in because of how Denver keeps switching things up. So it feels like an entire defensive thing, because when you take away what they've been doing they want to be a switch heavy team. That's what they love doing. That's what they're best at. And then they want to sprinkle in zone, and, like, yes, they'll do Spo's magic clipboard stuff with trying out a million different things, which worked in game two. But again, like, when you take away their base, not completely, but you alter what their base wants to be from being really aggressive on switches. Like, think about the Knicks series with how much did we really see them play drop against the Knicks? Like, that wasn't a big deal. That wasn't a lot of what they were doing. A lot of it was just being able to flat out switch and blow things up. Same thing against the Celtics. And now it's like, okay, well, we're having to put Bam in all these different positions. And it's not that he's a bad drop defender, but it's for what their entire defense is, it just makes it so much harder for them to actually keep things in front or just take away what they want to. And even then, like, it's not like it's bad defense. It's just Nikola Jokic shoots 55% from the mid-range.
Well, that's the other point I wanted to bring up here. I actually think Jimmy Butler did fine getting through this screen. Like, he fought over the top. He got low. He, like, wrapped himself totally around Jokic in the way you're supposed to. And then he's back. Like, he's recovered. He's onto his hip. He's not back in front, but Bam is there to show to get back in front. And then he gets back in front. That's about as good as you can expect from Jimmy Butler there. It's just that Bam, again, like, not overly big. Like, it's a little bit hard for Bam. Next up here, next possession down the court, quite literally, 5:15 mark of the first. Jokic catches the inbounds pass, just flips the dribble handoff quickly to Jamal Murray here, right? Mm-hmm. And at that point, you're getting Jamal Murray downhill, and things are going to be tough. Again, they have to basically trap it here. This is, again, essentially like a drop coverage situation from Bam. Bam is basically at the foul line here. He's trying to contain Jamal Murray, hoping that Jimmy can get back. But again, you let Jokic just get a free run to the basket by doing that. You have to be able to get back quicker if you're Bam Adebayo. And it's just hard. Like, I don't even know that they do anything particularly like incorrectly. You could maybe say that Bam stays just a split second too long here and commits to Jamal Murray thinking that he's going to shoot here. So you can see that like his weight distribution is like up on his like toes basically there. But I just, it's hard. Like, it's just really hard to deal with that kind of action.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I think the only, like, I mean, people could look at this and be like, well, what if, you know, Gabe Vincent came over and like got a hand on Jokic or something like that? Okay, cool. But then you have, I mean, I actually wouldn't mind that because you have Bruce Brown one pass away, and if he takes a shot, fine. But regardless, like when you think about who else is on the court, okay, well, they didn't play Bruce Brown a ton tonight. This was more of, I mean, they played Bruce Brown a ton. I'm sorry, looking at the minutes wrong. But like, it's more like, okay, yeah, well, if that's Christian Brown, like, okay, that's harder. Or even if you do swing it to Bruce and he doesn't take the shot, well, he's going to drive because he has a pocket to attack. And like, it's not as simple as just trying to condense the floor down like that because they have,
okay, personally, here's the thing. Difficult. Even if it's Gabe Vincent, even if Gabe Vincent is the help man there and you do have him go from where he is now, which is guarding Bruce Brown, and you have him dig in and tag Jokic as the roller, as the high man on the weak side, He's just going to shoot over the top.
Yeah.
like Gabe Vincent, like doesn't, we're literally going to see a clip here later. Like, he's just going to shoot over the top. And Jokic is such a good mid-range shooter that that's a 55% shot probably, right? Mm-hmm. So I don't even know that it's – I guess it's better.
Yeah, I just mean like more about making it difficult to put the ball on the ground is all. Like, yeah, if he can at least, like, stunt over and be, like, in his grill so he can't just step into it, that's more what I mean.
Yeah, it's fair. Like, that's a better option, I think. So here we're going to see another two-man action. Jokic – going to come through. He tells, I believe that's Jeff Green in the corner, stay low there. You're going to see his hands up right here.
I will say too, I actually think that we might see some more of them, at least trying to, with the Heat trying to get really adventurous with some of the tags on the inside like that, because it's what they did in the Celtics series. So yeah. I wouldn't think it's too crazy if they ended up doing more of it here. Obviously harder. This team moves the ball a lot better, but just straight thought.
It's going to be hard. So here you'll see Jokic. He's telling Jeff Green, like, stay low here. This is at the 2-minute mark of the first quarter. He's going to come back. He's going to set this screen, and Murray is going to reject it and go to the middle. And here, this is actually them putting two on the ball. This is not a drop. And because he rejects it, Cody Zeller feels like he has to come up and, like, actually just guard him. I don't know. Does this strike you as miscommunication or like actual strategy here to put?
I think it's miscommunication, but also like that's part of what's so difficult in doing this, because again, the way that Jokic flips the screen, he makes it hard for Caleb to get back into the play. But also like when you have, I mean, this just speaks to their ability to play together. Cause like, all right, you notice how they're covering and how they've been covering the entire first quarter. And then you escape, dribble it back out. So I think as a defender, like you're naturally seeing that. It's like, oh, well, I don't want to give him this pocket to shoot. I know Caleb's getting back over, but also like, because you can see him trying to recover back, but like it's already too late at that point. You've already given up the gap, and it's just, that's really difficult. But even then, like, okay, you get great help from Jimmy, but then, oh, hey, Jeff Green's back there. And now Jokic is just, he's Nikola Jokic. I honestly don't think this is terrible defense. I think it's just, yeah.
Yeah, no, I don't think it is either. I don't really have a way that they played this other than like the only thing that I would say is that Cody Zeller, you know, after Caleb Martin recovers back here, right here, He just drops backward. He doesn't go to Jokic. He just drops like kind of backward.
Yeah, exactly. But again, I do think like just speaking in general, like that's part of what makes it so hard because Jamal does a really with just that one dribble back. He does such a great job of pulling him out 3 feet.
Yeah.
And that makes it that much harder to get back. So,
yeah. And I agree. Like, honestly, like Cody ends up having to step up again because Jamal beats Caleb Martin off the bounce with that little quick little, you know, sidestep dribble, then quickly gets downhill. You know, it doesn't really matter what Cody Zeller does there. And then, like you said, Jimmy Butler does a good job getting in the play. It's just that Jokic has tricks for days and he's going to score in that area. 7 minute mark of the second quarter. Now we're going to see Christian Brown fake like he's going to come up and take a handoff and instead cut through the play. That is just classic Denver Nuggets stuff. If the man who is the low man there, I believe that's Kyle Lowry, right? Yeah. If he's not all the way over, that's just like an easy cut and bucket for Nikola Jokic, because Max Strus is beat here, right? It might be Duncan. I think it's Duncan, actually. Duncan is beat here on this cut, but because Kyle's there, it's not a pass to make. So instead, hand off to Jamal Murray. And again, this is a drop from Bam Adebayo. But now, as you mentioned earlier, what we're starting to see is the help at the elbow from Jimmy Butler. This is to try and cut off Jamal Murray from getting downhill. Heavy help at the elbow. This is something they did against the Knicks a lot, if I remember correctly, right?
Yeah.
So the heavy help at the elbow comes. You essentially end up in a situation where trapping Jimmy Butler, but then you get the switch with Caleb Martin on to Nikola Jokic. And that is also not exactly what you want from a possession. This just goes into Jokic. And now we're going to see here, Jeff Green, I believe that is going to cut 45 and occupy Kyle Lowry. Kyle Lowry instead doesn't occupy or doesn't like stay there to stay with Jeff Green. Green gets the pass from Jokic. He's at the basket. Another awesome help rotation again, by the way, from Jimmy Butler. Jimmy Butler was not bad in this game defensively. When I say that, like, I think Miami like went after him a little bit, I think Jimmy Butler was great defensively. It's just that they're really fucking hard to guard. And I felt like they wanted to get him in screens a little bit more than Gabe Vincent. So here, this is about as good as you can defend them.
Yeah, that's the one of the shots I was referencing earlier. Like, that's just when you get one of those, like, I don't know what you do. And I think, like, again, just to hit on that, because I and I don't mean you, but I just think in general, whenever somebody says attack, they, you know, they think bad. But I think it's more okay if we pull Jimmy out of being a help defender. Like, obviously he gets 100% back in as a help defender. Like, but if we if we make Gabe Vincent and Kyle Lowry your back line, that just makes it that much easier to get stuff going downhill when we do get downhill. So,
yep. It's 100% right. It's not just like one thing or the other. It's all connected, right? So again, just to run it through, forces the help from Kyle Lowry, gets the dribble handoff here. You get the great help here from Jimmy. The double, but now you're on Jokic. Caleb Martin does a fairly good job standing him up, comes through the play. Great help rotation from Jimmy. Great scramble out from Bam on the closeout. Adjusts, closes out on Jamal Murray, and it's just like, what the fuck do you do? Mm-hmm. Like, I don't even know. That's tough. So here, Jokic is going to get the ball. We're going to see more two-man game, and this is just, you know, this is where Jamal Murray's feeling it on that next possession.
Well, yeah, because right here, it's like, all right, well, they're going to switching in this, and then, okay, well, kind of slip, kind of screen, and obliterate the switch pocket. Like,
yeah.
Because I think it's probably more of a late switch than just an outright switch, because it's not really super aggressive from Bam. But again, like, that's okay. If you're able to get them out on the island like that, and that's just, I mean, I think this is not to get on my soapbox. I think that they need to start, if we're being honest about how offenses are getting to, like, I do think that they need to start officiating screens differently. Like, it is... I'm not trying to be a curmudgeon, but it is like legitimately so hard with the way that to actually defend shit, the way that screens get blended together. And I love watching it. I think it's really cool, but I think legitimately as a defense, how the fuck are you supposed to guard that at times?
Well, here's the thing. So, like, that's not an illegal screen.
It's not an illegal screen. He didn't actually set the screen. Yeah, no, I mean, like, not necessarily just this one in general, but like, there's a lot of illegal screens.
But the reason that that happens, the reason that that peel switch essentially happens there, is because of the anticipation of the illegal screen.
No, exactly. Like, I just mean, I sorry, this was the wrong clip to go off on it about, but I was thinking about that a lot tonight, because there was a lot of times where I'm watching, just like, I don't know how you're supposed to do anything with that. I'm not saying that like it has to be perfect every time, but it is like, I don't know. There's just a lot of gray area with it. It's very gray.
Yeah. So next possession here is, I think, going to be in the third. Yeah. We get to the 10:30 mark of the third quarter. Two-man game again. And now you'll see here that they have Max Strus on Jamal Murray.
Mm-hmm.
Strus goes under. You get the pump fake, and now we're just like empty-sided out, essentially. Trying to remember if this is the one where Jokic. No, it's not. But I mean, it's just empty side, and it's just a fucking impossible guard, essentially. You get Jokic into like a one-on-one with an empty side of the court, as good as Bam Adebayo is, it's just going to be exceptionally difficult. Bam tries to close out. Jokic is so unbalanced that it's just really hard to close out on him and not allow him to drive. And that forces the help from Kevin Love. And then that's going to open up the situation for Aaron Gordon to be able to slip off of Kevin Love and be wide open for a lob. I don't even think Jimmy is late on this rotation. It's just that Bam got beat so badly at the point of attack here on this closeout that that's just a hard rotation for Jimmy, right?
Yeah, I love setting the flare screen for Jokic too, because exactly like you mentioned, that's what opens up the gap to attack too. Like,
yep.
If the flare screen isn't there, then okay, he's out on Jokic and it's not anything that you're worried about, but it just makes it that much harder. I don't know. That one, I don't necessarily love how Bam handled it, but I also don't really know how else you're supposed to, because if you try and go over top, well, then Jokic can shoot the gap on a driving lane on the outside because he has the capability to do that. So it's like, you know, that's just not fun. And that speaks to how incredible Jokic is. Like, cool, let's set a 4-5 flare screen in an empty corner for you and make something happen. Like,
I mean, it's probably not what you want. Like, this is, I don't even know if you'd like go through this on tape, like if you're the Heat, but like you probably just switch that. But that's like against their defensive principles to switch that. Like, that's probably the ideal thing there is Kevin Love just guards Nikola Jokic.
Yeah.
But like, that's not what they do. So like you're forcing him to go out and around, and you're forcing the heavy close out. Like, once you start getting into circumstances where you're like, okay, if they set this specific flare screen on the empty side for Jokic, switch it. If they don't, then you've got so many things going on in your head. And like, Bam Adebayo and Kevin Love are smart, highly intelligent NBA players. That's just hard to remember everything. Like, we've gone through like 9 different types of plays, and they've gotten into this 2-man game 9 separate ways, right? Mm-hmm. Imagine having to remember assignments for, they run this every single time down the court, the 2-man game with Jokic and Murray. Imagine having to remember assignments for 50 different ways they can get into a 2-man game. Like, that's why you have defensive principles, not necessarily, you know, exact strategies against this specific set that they're running. It's just hard. It's really fucking hard, I think. So the next possession here, I think it is literally the next possession down the court. You're going to see a left side ball screen with Jokic and Murray here. I want to make sure that I get the front end of this possession in case it's something. So yeah, it is. So you're going to see here Jokic tells Michael Porter Jr. and I think specifically Aaron Gordon, stay on that side. That's what he's doing with his hands. Like, stay over there. He wants the empty side again, because again, it's literally the same possession, or it's the next possession after the previous one where they just got the empty side action, right? Mm-hmm. So he's saying, Aaron, if you stay over there, we have Kevin Love as the low man here, and we have this empty side, and Jamal here is coming down. He's getting the ball downhill. Jamal turns the corner on Bam. Turn the corner on Bam's hard. Bam's really good defensively. But because he turns the corner on him, Kevin's the low man and help. This is just an easy pass to Aaron Gordon. Easy dunk for Aaron Gordon. I mean, this is why Nikola Jokic is who he is, even beyond the fact that he can dribble like a guard, pass better than any player in the NBA right now, shoot 60% from the mid-range and 35% from three. Oh, by the way, look at him processing this, saying to Aaron, stay over in the corner, stay over in the corner, and just like running shit all the time, right? It's just sick. It's just absolutely sick. Jamal Murray here coming up. This is another screen. This time it's a little catch drop. Bam does a good job recovering. Again, quick little drop. Bam. This time they have to peel switch. And if you peel switch with Gabe Vincent onto Nikola Jokic, speaking of that previous possession that we talked about in the first half, you are dead. You are dead. Gabe Vincent did as well as he humanly could here. Look at how aggressive he is. He's contacting him immediately at the 20-foot mark away from the basket. He's getting low. He's trying to force him into a tougher spot. Gabe Vincent's doing everything you would ask of him here. He's doing every single thing. He's in his grill. He's in his space. He's just too small. This is why having a 6'10" guy that can dribble pass shoot like that is so difficult and good. Next one. Jokic comes up after that little, I don't know, what do you want to call this? This is sort of a Spain action. They're almost playing it like it's a screen for Jokic to go to the corner from Christian Brown, but instead it ends up being just a screen for Jokic to go up. So it's sort of a Spain action. It's like a delayed or like an early Spain action. And here, what Miami starts doing off of this action, God damn it. I believe this is it. No, it's the next one. They handle the initial action well. Bam comes up, gets at the level. Jimmy is there. Jimmy's just on Christian Brown at this point. Everybody's in pretty good position. Everybody's where you want them at this point. Bam probably has to start recovering sooner here. But Jimmy shoots up to Jokic because he realizes that somebody has to shoot up to Jokic. Otherwise, Nikola Jokic is wide open, and that's a bad thing. I don't know if you knew that, Mark.
Yeah. Personally, though, like I know because he's – I mean, he's zoning up. That's his job. But I think that Jokic shooting threes is kind of just where – if I can make him shoot threes instead of shooting from mid-range, by all means. But I think, to me, this possession is even more about – Jamal's ability to handle traps and not just like handle them, I should just say ball pressure because it's not technically a trap. It's more just he's able to drag out the defense. But his ability to drag out the defense, whether he does, and kind of manipulate what they're doing to open up what's on the backside, like that, that's really good shit.
I think Jamal's a really underrated. I don't even know if like underrated passer is the right word. I think he is a really underrated playmaker for his teammates in terms of manipulating defenses in that way. Mm-hmm. Like, it doesn't always lead to a Jamal Murray assist necessarily, but he's really, really good, I think, at stringing out defenders and forcing advantageous situations for Denver. This time it does lead to an assist because Jimmy goes up and helps on Nikola Jokic, and that is just Christian Brown's cue. I'm going to cut to the rim because that's what I do. And he cuts to the rim, scores, gets fouled, and one. Christian Brown, terrific game tonight. This might be the last clip we've got here. This is at the 3:44 mark of the fourth quarter. And again, same coverage again. Essentially a catch drop from Bam. Bam does a pretty good job recovering onto Jokic. Jokic is just too good. He's just too good. He's too good at basketball. To be able to manage that situation. And when that's going to be the case, it's going to be really hard. It's going to be really, really hard for Miami. I think that's my takeaway. That all of this, by the way, is why I say at the top of this show, it's hard for me to like get fully invested in this series because I just think Denver is a lot better than they are. Like at the end of the day, I just think Denver is way more talented and pressures the Miami defense drastically more than Miami pressures the Denver defense. And oh, by the way, they have the best player on the court and they have the third best player on the court and they have the fifth, sixth, and maybe seventh best players on the court. It's a problem. That's my take, Mark. It's a problem.
I agree with your take. I'm interested to see if Miami can cook something up. But to me, I mean, my pick before the series was Denver in five. I said it the other night when I was on NBA Spaces. I said I still felt pretty comfortable about Denver in five, and I think that's where we're at.
Yeah, when I did the Tab NBA tip-off show, I said that bettors should sprinkle on a Denver sweep, but I thought that Denver in five was probably the right choice. Sweep didn't happen because Miami got like a crazy aberrant shooting night from three. Although I think that Denver certainly allowed them to by not playing quite as tight defensively as they did in game one or in game three. But this is where we're at now. We're in a situation where I think we probably end up with a quick five-game series. It's the reality. Okay, Mark, let's go to Chris Paul now, I think, right?
Yeah, that feels like a logical going point.
Chris Paul. Chris Haynes reported earlier in the day that Chris Paul would likely be Chris Paul would likely be waived, if I remember correctly, was the terminology, right? I can pull up the tweet while
we're talking. Yeah, I don't have the direct tweet in front of me, but I think that was correct.
Yeah, so Chris Haynes, who, by the way, Chris Haynes is unbelievable. One of the best reporters that you will find. Suns have notified star Chris Paul that he will be waived, making the future Hall of Famer one of the top free agents this offseason, sources tell NBA on TNT. If you look through what Woj has now reported, he is saying, and I quote, Phoenix Suns ownership and executives had a series of conversations with Chris Paul and his representatives on the all-star point guard's future with the franchise on Wednesday, including the possibility that he could be waived by the NBA's June 28th guarantee date on his contract. The Suns insist they're still working through several possibilities for Paul's future and reiterated to his representatives later Wednesday afternoon, sources said. Phoenix plans to explore trade opportunities, including Paul and DeAndre Ayton, that could alter the franchise's roster landscape ahead of a final decision on Paul's partially guaranteed contract. So all of that sounds right to me. It makes sense that they would be looking through a number of different options with Chris Paul and with DeAndre Ayton.
Mm-hmm.
I got some pushback when I was like, oh, wow, that's like a total stunner that on the Chris Haynes original report. The reason I tweeted that was not because, like, I think Chris Paul is worth $30 million a year still. It's because almost all of Phoenix's flexibility this offseason is, like, a little bit contingent upon either A, finding a home for DeAndre Ayton in somebody's cap space, and then stretching and waving or waving and stretching Chris Paul, and then trying to use cap space yourself, or it's incumbent upon them like moving Chris Paul and DeAndre Ayton separately for other pieces that they think maybe fit the roster better.
Yeah.
It's more of a mechanics thing than anything else, right?
Yeah. No, exactly. And I think maybe I could be wrong, but it feels like part of this is speaking a little bit to what they felt their potential to actually make something shake in a CP move was. I don't know. Maybe I'm thinking too hard on that, but that was kind of where my mind went a little bit in seeing that.
Did you say like ownership, like finances and like roster finances?
No, not finance. Sorry. I just mean in general, like I'd imagine that they've been poking around about, okay, what kind of moves could we actually make? And maybe they were just like, yeah, there's not a lot of teams that are like, we don't feel good about anything we can do to make something happen here. That's all just assumption, but that's kind of where my mind went a little bit.
Yeah. I wonder if that is true, to be honest. I do think there is a possibility that that's very true. I do think somebody will want DeAndre Ayton. I think somebody will give up like,
oh no, I meant Chris, not DeAndre.
but the two are kind of tied together, I guess, is my point. Like, I think a team will give up assets for DeAndre Ayton. I wonder if they would give up assets for Chris Paul. Chris Paul, you have to remember too, like, that contract, I think, is actually somewhat valuable. It only has $15 million guaranteed for next year. If you move him before June 28th, you can treat him as like a $15 million salary that you're trading, and then you can cut Chris Paul, and then there's like nothing left on that deal. So like theoretically, a team that has like a three-year contract on a guy that they don't really want, say that like Phoenix really, or say like a longer-term extension, a longer-term deal that they really don't want at like $15 million, that the Suns value as a player, right? I don't necessarily know who this is. I'm just like spitballing here.
Yeah.
They could trade Chris Paul for that player, and then that team could cut Chris Paul and get like a bunch of cap space, essentially. If a team wants cap space, they can trade anywhere from $15 to $35 million players to the Phoenix Suns. And then they will have a guaranteed number that they will then have to pay Chris Paul at $15 million. And they'll be able to get like a little bit more, a little bit freer cap space. Maybe a team is like $5 million away from having max cap space and they need max cap space for some sort of ridiculous plan this summer that almost assuredly wouldn't work given who is available on the market. A way to do that is by acquiring Chris Paul. So for it to come out a month before or 3 weeks before it's necessary for any decision to be made, that's what was stunning to me. Priorities change closer to the draft. Like, I can't imagine a world where the Suns don't take Chris Paul into the draft, right? Like, you definitely want, you want that contract because you want the flexibility on draft night, I think.
Mm-hmm. No, I get what you're saying. That makes sense to me.
So the question for me is, if you are the Phoenix Suns, the other piece of this before I move to that part of it, Brian Windhorst, like, sort of kind of alluded to like a potential outcome here that involves the Suns waiving Chris Paul, not stretching his contract, and then just re-signing him basically for like a minimum deal or something along those lines. If Chris Paul wants to stay in Phoenix long-term, gives them a little bit more flexibility. If you do that, you keep Chris Paul, and then maybe you can move DeAndre Ayton to somebody's space, and then you do get, you know, not quite max cap space because you're still paying Chris Paul $16 million this year. But, like, it's just interesting. Like, if you're the Suns, what are you looking to surround Chris Paul with? Or what are you looking to surround Devin Booker and Kevin Durant with moving forward?
Players like Christian Brown, honestly. Not just saying straight up like Christian Brown, but like, mm-hmm. I think they really need players who can play off of them. Because I think that was something that they lacked this year. Like, they need guys who can be quality shooters when left open, that can make quick decisions attacking a defense, whether that means moving the ball or moving themselves or attacking the rim. And I think that was just something that there was a dearth of on that roster this year, even before Kevin Durant came in. Like, yes, even with – like, I thought – I mean, that's part of what made Mikhail and Cam so good on that team, is those are two guys who are adept at doing that, especially with how good Mikhail got attacking the rim this year with his own handle too, you know, not just off of cuts. Like, I think okay, well, we have Torrey Craig and Landry Shamet and Terrence Ross sometimes, and that respectfully is like not even close to the same. And I think, yeah, to me, that's very much what you need around them, especially with Chris. Like, I still think Chris is – I saw some takes that were like pretty wild about Chris today, like not being a vet min guy or like not being an MLE player, and I like very heartily disagree with that. I think that his days of being a max player are long behind us, and they honestly have been for – a year or two now with where we're at. But he's still incredibly serviceable and important for what a team can do. I do question a little bit about what some of the playoffs is going to look like, but I think that's more about who, like you mentioned, who else is around him, you know, what can that look like? And yeah.
Do you think DeAndre Ayton's on this roster next year?
No, I don't think he should be, to be honest. I'm not saying that it's his fault that they lost in the playoffs, but watching him in the playoffs was just beyond dispiriting for somebody who really enjoys his talent and what he's capable of doing. I don't know. I just think it's pretty clear that this is done. Like, I guess, you know, reportedly, Monty and him did not get along. I wonder if maybe part of the idea of parting with Monty was, hey, maybe we can try and figure things out with DeAndre. But just based on how this last year went, like, I would be pretty out on him being back with the Suns. I think that they're at a point of, like, and even then, like, to be fair too, like, are you getting somebody as talented as DeAndre in a trade for him? No. But do you get somebody who maybe fits the roster a little bit better, potentially? Like, obviously DeAndre is an incredibly talented player, and I think at his best can be incredible defensively. At his average can be pretty blah defensively, and doesn't, like, when he's at his best, he covered a lot of holes on this team.
Totally.
But the problem was that was not often enough. Like, and I'm not trying to put him on blast, but, like, I do think that just stood out a ton this year.
He was not as good defensively as he should have been this year.
Yeah,
I don't think that's unfair to say.
Yeah, and I just think in general, like, they need somebody who can be more consistent defensively, and I think having somebody who is a more forceful roller and just more forceful paint presence is going to be really important for the team next year, because that's where I think they really lacked. Like, it's awesome that he has the touch he does from, like, 3 feet out. But also, like, I think they really just needed somebody who could punish the rim at times. And that's why they went with Jock Landale at times, because, like, he was going to more forcefully attack the rim, and he was going to play a little bit. Like, he was just a different kind of roller and player. And I think, like, that speaks at large to what I would like to see them try and do. But, I mean, if that – I just think it would be a mistake to go into the next year with DeAndre still on the roster, with how much is still ambiguous with – what his actual fit is, and if anything would really be different next year.
So I want to be careful with what I say. I don't think it's a certainty that DeAndre Ayton's off this roster next year is what I would say, I guess. Wouldn't surprise me if they keep him, if only because Frank Vogel has a very good track record with, like, athletic bigs like this. You know, you can look through, you know, Anthony Davis, obviously he was there with early Miles Turner, if I remember correctly, in Indiana. You would know that better than I do, Mark.
Correct? Wait, sorry, can you repeat that?
Frank Vogel was Miles Turner's first coach, correct?
Yes. Yeah. Miles was shit. Miles drafted 2015, which is wild to think about, but yeah. He was Miles' first coach, and then he got fired, and it was Nate.
Right. So I believe that the idea here behind Frank Vogel, not necessarily, like, I think they'll explore all options. It's very possible DeAndre Ayton could get moved, as Adrian Wojnarowski just said, right? Totally think that's a real potential outcome. I think it's more of an exploration than, like, a certainty, though. Like, I think they actually want to see what's out on the market, and they would bring him back next year if they couldn't find what they want on the market. Essentially, which is, what do they want? Like, it's a great question. Like, if you're Portland and you take Scoot Henderson or something like that, right? Do you look to offload Anfernee Simons at that point? And, like, would you do Anfernee Simons in 23 for DeAndre Ayton?
If I'm the Suns, probably not. Like, I like Anfernee, but I just, like, what does that really do for them? Like, I think I feel like some Suns fans would hear that and be like, what are you talking about? I think that's great. From a talent perspective, I think it's great. But in terms of what this team, like, actually needs, I don't know if that really does anything for me.
I don't either, for what it's worth.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I'm just honestly spitballing. I probably wouldn't do that if I was Phoenix, if only because you're trying to win a title, like, immediately right now. And I don't think Anfernee Simons helps you win a title as much as DeAndre Ayton does when you're – what is your replacement level center option at that point? It's, yeah. you know, somebody because you probably wouldn't even have access to the mini mid level at that point. I mean, you could bring back Nurkic in that deal. You could do Simons and Nurkic. I think that works financially, but Nurkic was quite poor this year.
Yeah.
And then you have Nurkic for 3 more years after this one, if I remember correctly. So not a deal. I guess that, like, does Simons, Nurkic in a first do you more help than just having DeAndre Ayton? If I'm Portland, by the way, like, I do that to get off of the Nurkic deal. Like, I'm sprinting to do that, to get off the Nurkic deal.
I don't think it's like that level of bad for me.
I think it's pretty fucking bad.
Like, no, I think that the Nurkic deal is bad, but I think for me, because it seems like they have no interest in trading Shaden, which I get to an extent, but also
I agree with them.
I would think about it pretty heavily. Or I guess it just, like, for me, if I'm like, I think Dame is still going to be a top 10 player next year and I want to do something with that, I would understand trading Shaden. Except my point more is, like, I think Anthony is, like, the ability for them to really make a massive move that's not just some, hey, we tinkered with the roster again around the edges. And I feel like they can't afford to mess that up.
The other thing for Portland is that their contract structure is actually quite difficult to manage right now. Mm-hmm. If you look at their cap sheet moving forward, Nurkic and Simons are their only players currently under contract between $45 million and $6 million, which just makes it very difficult functionally to do trades. And there's real opportunity cost because of that to moving those guys, or moving both of them. Let's say if you move one of them, you can then have the other one to financially match in potential trade options. But if you move both of them in one deal, it gets a little bit trickier. I probably would not do that if I was either side, I think, weirdly. Maybe I would. I don't know. I have to think about that more. That's intriguing. In a few ways, they'll have the Matisse. I'm assuming they're going to sign Thybulle, and I'm assuming he'll get like 440 or something like that, 330, whatever. So he'll have a contract like kind of in the middle that allows them some flexibility, but not a ton. Is there any other deal for Phoenix that, like, you can look at on the market? I'm really truly struggling finding, like, the deal that makes Phoenix better than what they are right now, I guess is my point.
If you're Phoenix, and obviously, like, noting that maybe the Durant trade doesn't happen if you do it, but, like, do you look back and you're like, wow, maybe we should have done the Ayton for Miles Turner deal?
Was that actually on the table?
It was not. It was, like, loosely reported. I can't remember who had that. But obviously, I mean, because the Pacers accepted had sent the offer and they matched it, of course. But, like, so I don't remember if it was, like, fully on the table, but I know it was brought up a couple times.
I mean, look, if it was on the table, Matt Ishbia, I think, like, I don't even know if he knew he was bidding at that point, like, for the Suns, or, like, maybe he was just doing, like, very cursory looks into potentially buying the Suns at that point, right? So, like, I don't know. I get your question. I think it's a reasonable question. It's just hard for me to look at it with that kind of, that kind of, like, backward thought process, given that. It's really, really hard for me to find the team, because, like, you need to find the team for Ayton. I don't think Indiana would be interested at this point because they got Turner on the 2-year, like, sweetheart contract, because they gave him the balloon payment this year. So that doesn't make sense for you, right? Going to get DeAndre for Indiana anymore?
Probably not.
Yeah, it doesn't really line up for me. I mean, Toronto filled their center hole with Jakob Poeltl in all likelihood, it seems like. Maybe, like, if you really squint, could you get Washington to do something like a Kristaps opt-in, where Kristaps says, I won't opt in if you don't trade me? So, like, you essentially do, like, an opt-in and trade for Kristaps for DeAndre Ayton.
That does nothing for me if I'm the Suns.
Kristaps was really good last year.
He was fine. Like, I mean, he was good. Like, I'm just speaking in terms of like relatives with the level. I still am just like very the injury stuff still really bothers me.
Yeah.
If I'm an organization, the consistency stuff still really bothers me if I'm an organization. And I still just think like, was he better than, he was better than Aiden this last year, to be fair. So, yeah. But I still think that's just like, for me, that I don't know if it's enough where I'm in love with it.
If Kristaps opts out and says, I'm not coming back to Washington, could you do something like Ayton for Daniel Gafford, Monte Morris, and like Denny? And just get like a bunch of depth pieces?
I guess. But at the same time, it's just kind of like, well, cool. Like, what does this do for us? Like, I do think.
I don't know what it does for Washington more than anything.
Yeah, like, no, for sure. Worth. I think it's just like, cool.
If Kristaps is leaving, now, then I would imagine Kyle Kuzma's leaving or getting drastically overpaid. Like, maybe if you drastically overpay Kuzma, you then have to find a center. If Kristaps says he's just leaving, I don't know. That's tricky. Yeah. That's a very tricky one. Yeah, I don't have the story here. And like, maybe you could say Charlotte, like Charlotte decides they want like a true center and they could move like Gordon Hayward. Could you do like Gordon Hayward and Rozier for Ayton and Chris Paul?
Oof, God.
And then like maybe nasty. You get something else from the Hornets as well.
I mean, I get why Charlotte would do that to get off Gordon's deal and kind of just be out on Terry. But
yeah, like if you think Gordon's quite good still.
He's okay. I think he's still really solid offensively, but his defense has fallen off a cliff for me. And maybe part of that is, I mean, I think a lot of that's just injuries, but I don't think that it, I mean, I think that he could be like, if you're, I actually do kind of like the idea of, but again, like we're talking about the injury aspect again. And like, if I know I'm getting Gordon for 80% of the season, 80-85% of the season, he's playing as the third or fourth option in my offense, I feel pretty good about that. But if I'm not getting him for 85% of the season, which, let me look at the last time he's, I mean, this year he played 50 games, and I think that was the most he's played since 2019-20 when he played 52 games, and that was Boston. So, like, yeah, that's tough to swallow. But again, I mean, if you feel good about his injury stuff,
well, you're into the same issues then that you have with Chris Paul, right?
Yeah.
Which if you'd rather have Chris Paul than Gordon Hayward still, right?
If I'm the Suns, probably.
Yes, I agree. My exercise here is not to say that I, you know, think any of these deals are good ideas. I don't think any of them are, frankly. And that's the point. It's actually somewhat difficult to find a DeAndre Ayton deal that fills the hole in the middle for Phoenix, adds to their depth, and like, you know, gives them the potential to like move Chris Paul elsewhere, essentially. Mm-hmm. Like the Washington one is the closest if Kristaps leaves and that team still decides it wants to compete. But there are starting to be some like little mini rumors out there that like the Wizards might kind of blow this thing up, according to Josh Robbins at The Athletic, by the way. Shout out Josh. Very nice human. I don't know what the Suns do. My point here is I have no idea what the Suns do. We will see where this goes. Period. Right. Do you have any other strong takes here? If I'm them, I'm trying to find ball movement and like a center that can really defend, which they might have. They might have it if they keep DeAndre, but.
And I think they really need a guard who can create a little bit off the bench. I don't know what draft picks do they have.
They have 51.
Oh yeah. And... that's not happening in the draft then. Yeah, because I think for me, like, I mean, Campaign's fall off this year was really rough for them, like dealing with his injury and just generally his play degraded a little bit. And I think that was a big struggle for them because, again, they had nobody who could really get into the paint and create anything on the roster. So, yeah, it makes it – I don't know what they're going to do. This has actually been very mind-fucking because I hadn't really thought about it to that depth with the Ayton piece. Yeah.
It feels like they're trying to reshape the roster around Booker and Durant and trying to find the best pieces that work for them. The funny thing is that if DeAndre Ayton would just fucking run hard to the rim every single time, he would be the perfect player for them. But he likes to short roll and likes to be in that little mid-range area, and it doesn't work as well. So, or like just rim run more often, maybe not every time. Like you can, having that versatility of skills is valuable, but just rim run more is kind of where I'm at, and like go up strong toward the basket. If you're Frank Vogel and you think you can get the most out of that, right? Like that's what you do.
Maybe. I think I will say one last thing I would want to say on this before we're done on Phoenix. I do think part of what's interesting in the Vogel hire, and this is, it's not like it's anything reported. I think this is just from talking to people, because I was a kid in 2012, 2013. Part of what was really cool about Frank in Indiana is like, and I think a lot of people don't know about this. Like, I mean, Roy Hibbert, it's like very well known that he clearly, I mean, had some struggles with confidence and stuff. Like that was a big part of why his career took a turn in at the end of 2014. But like, Vogel used to like, he worked one-on-one as a head coach with Roy constantly. And that is like, that's not typical to just have like a head coach who's working one-on-one all the time with this one guy who's like coming in and like just watching film by himself with this one player. And like, I do wonder if part of that is like, hey, you know, what if we like, not saying that that's all of it, but I'm like, what if the idea is we really think Frank is the guy who can get DeAndre Ayton to be DeAndre Ayton? Just a small wrinkle, I thought, but not that I, you know, that's grasping at something a little bit, but
yeah. Look, I don't think it's grasping at something. I would imagine that like the potential DeAndre Ayton is on this roster next year played a role in hiring Frank Vogel. Like, I don't know about a big role, but his track record with bigs is good.
Mm-hmm.
Like just straight up. And they have a big that is immensely talented and just hasn't gotten the most out of it up in or outside of that title season or the finals season. So yeah, I'm intrigued to see where it goes. Let's move toward the 2023 NBA draft. The first thing I want to talk about here is I'll start with this idea of promises. Mark, are you properly skeptical when you hear any report of promises?
Yes, because I know plenty of guys who have been offered a promise and then they didn't get drafted by a team. So I'm skeptical. Anything that's not even written, I'm pretty skeptical. Like written.
It's not even like the, yeah, like it's not even the, it, I think it does happen where like guys get like not full scale promises, but like some sort of like assurance and then they kind of fall behind, right? They fall lower than what they want.
Mm-hmm.
The reason I'm skeptical is it just really limits your flexibility 2 weeks out from the draft, A. And B, like, why would you do it? Like, if you're a team, like, the only reason that you promise somebody if you're a team, in my opinion, that makes, like, real logical sense is if you are trying to get that player to stay in the draft. For instance, it is well established at this point publicly that Zach Edey had an immense offer from Purdue in order to, if he was to go back to college, and he would make a lot of money. I don't know if I want to put a number on it, because I don't know if I've seen reports on it. Mm-hmm. And I've like, it's been speculated to me, but like not in any sort of real tangible way that I feel comfortable saying on mic that like is definitely accurate or anything.
Mm-hmm.
You needed to, in order to get Zach Edey to stay in the draft, you had to give him like a very significant assurance that if he stays in the draft, you are going to take him and you are going to pay him more than the minimum contract, essentially, that you get like second rounders, or you're going to have to take him in the first round. Like that's where a promise makes sense, is if you're trying to get Zach Edey or somebody to stay in the draft because they have a real substantial offer on the table from somebody else. That lines up, right?
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, the idea behind other promises is that you ask a guy to stop working out for other teams. And by stopping him from working out for other teams, you then stop them from taking him. Teams are getting smarter. Like, I think they're just going to be willing to take guys, like, even if they don't come to their gym. Point blank. Jabari Smith, if I remember correctly, did not go to Houston last year to work out. Different circumstance. He fell from 1 to 3, right? But that didn't stop him from taking him. There are a lot of examples of guys who like go places and it doesn't stop them from taking somebody. So yeah, I don't know, man. Anytime I hear X player has a promise or it's opposing teams think X player has a promise, I'm so skeptical of it. There is one that I'm kind of doing some digging on that maybe I'll share online that I'm a little bit, or share offline that I'm a little bit intrigued by. But again, like I would never report that or like say that on stream. Cause like, I don't think that it's a certainty first and foremost. And like, there's gotta be some sort of like journalistic integrity on this stuff to me. I don't know. It's bizarre. It's the promise industry. There's a promise industrial complex because I think that everybody likes the, like, is the promise like some sort of sexy thing that happens? Like, is that why it gets reported on like ad nauseum in the way it does?
I don't know. I think it's just because it sounds like it's ambiguous enough that you can make it seem legit without actually providing a name or sourcing, because it's like, well, I'm not allowed to say I can't divulge my sources. So like,
yeah,
I'm not saying that everybody who says it is lying, but it is very easy to just be like, well, you know, this, my guy has a promise, my guy this, my guy that. So I, you know,
I'm just going to start doing that. I'm just going to go, oh folks, Victor Wembanyama, he has a promise from San Antonio Spurs, number one overall pick. It's a promise. It's done. It's happening.
Yeah.
It's like, no shit, he's going number one over. Like, I'm just going to do like the most obvious ones now from this point forward. Yeah, you know, Vic, you got promise number one. That's it. It's done. It's the only promises that make sense. Yeah, I don't know. It's so silly. It's so silly. Let's talk about Dariq Whitehead now. Because I'd imagine Dariq Whitehead is a player that probably does not have any sort of real assurance at this point on where he's going to go. It was reported earlier today by Adrian Wojnarowski that it was the statement was that the doctor that did his second surgery will be likely to be on track for training camp, essentially. Martin O'Malley, who's like a very well-renowned surgeon, he conducted a revision operation with bone grafting for a fifth metatarsal Jones fracture. For people who know Jones fractures, it's what Kevin Durant had that held him out for quite a bit of time. These are not good things. There are different types of Jones fractures, but these are not good things that occur. Foot injuries are very difficult to manage. They sap your explosiveness. They sap your like shooting ability a lot of the time because you're taking off and landing on your feet whenever you shoot. These are very tricky injuries. It's why NBA teams are always so cognizant and worried about them. What do we think ends up happening with Dariq Whitehead now? Because this is like, so I'll reveal this. I have Dariq at 20 on my board. That's going to be the final spot for him. I believe in Dariq. I believe in him as a player. Everything you hear about him is like very mature, human, like someone that you can like believe in, essentially, to like reach his ceiling. Someone that you can believe in to like work through this injury someone that just played through pain the entire year at Duke, seemingly, given the fact that it required a second surgery after the original one in the offseason previously.
Mm-hmm.
Where are you on Derek?
I think I'm the same as you. I think the talent is so obvious, especially having watched him a ton at Montverde. I just remained in the camp all year that everything was due to injury. I wasn't really too worried about play. I think it was more just noting that it's going to take time for his body to get right. I think exactly like you said, it is discouraging to have this happen. By no means is this better for him, but I think the idea of him and where he could end up in the 20s is intriguing for what his future prospects are and just for teams in the 20s, to be honest. Like, I think when you look at, like, let's just say Miami's at 18, and I think that Derek would actually be a super interesting pull for them, unless they want to do something where it's an immediate talent grab. Not that he's not immediate, but I think, like, this is kind of hitting the zone of, like, we really need to be careful with him in his rookie year and just focus on getting his body right, which is also part of the reason why Miami's interesting. But, yeah, I mean, kind of like you mentioned, I think it's just a lot's going to depend on how confident you are in your strength and conditioning and athletic training staff to put together a plan with him and kind of figure out where he's at and what he can do this coming year. And not to speculate too much on that, but yeah.
The spot that interests me is actually, you know, a team that you watch quite closely. Indiana 26 and 28. I'd imagine they probably keep one of those picks. I can't imagine Rick Carlisle wanting to go into next year with like three rostered rookies. Can you? And by the way, they have 32 as well.
He can't do it another year.
That would be, that's not something that Rick Carlisle seems wildly interested in. But then again, like Rick apparently has like some sway with the front office now. Maybe he's willing to pick the guys that like he's willing to go to.
I will say, with. I mean, Derek is very much a Rick player, like really good shooter. I mean, obviously very good shooter, like obviously can do a lot of the jab series stuff that is really cool and makes him and like his space creation ability, especially out of the mid range, is really exciting for me. I love his ability to drive, which obviously that was not there at Duke. I think like you saw some of the stuff to still do some of his lateral creation stuff at Duke that was exciting. But I think when you're talking about just a player who can make good decisions without having to be the primary decision maker, like he's a really interesting player who could fit alongside Tyrese Haliburton to me. And they need a player who's like actually a wing, not a straight up two guard like Benedict Mathurin is. And I think like to me too, like Derek is a much better defender than I think he showed at Duke this year. Clearly, I feel like that was the most where I felt his like obviously people would point out his explosiveness, but I think a lot of it was defensively too. Like he was not himself. So I think to me, like just adding a player like that who I'm not really worried about from the feel aspect of the game. I don't think that he's like, you know, a Tyrese level kind of feel guy, but I think generally I think about him as a pretty solid feel player, somebody who just is going to make the right plays and could fit in, especially like playing in an offense as motion heavy as theirs and just read and react. I think he would fit in beautifully in that. So I think Rick would very much enjoy him as a player.
Yeah, I think that's a really good one. The other connection worth making here is that Brooklyn has both 21 and 22, and Martin O'Malley is the Brooklyn Nets team orthopedist. And Martin O'Malley is also the person who did this surgery on Derek Whitehead. So you would think that the Nets will have very good intel on this at the very least. They'll be able to understand what's happening with Derek at like a pretty reasonable level, certainly. I would love to see him there. I think that makes a lot of sense. I know that they are looking, you know, for wings and bigger players who can handle the ball and everything. Certainly their roster screams that at the very least. I'm going to have Alex Schiffer on at some point. I think I'm writing something with Alex right now on the Nets. That roster is, I think Nets fans are like way too high on what that roster is. because that they are nowhere near contending. And then they also don't have any of their high value picks until like 2027. And then if you're going to move those high value picks from the future, you're removing them. And then you're trying to get like Damian Lillard or something like that. Like a Damian Lillard, Mikal Bridges, Cam Johnson, Ben Simmons team does not contend for a title, right?
Yeah. Even if Ben's like back to who he used to be 3 years ago, that's not a contender probably.
So I'm just like very unclear on what their trajectory is at this point. But like Dariq is in it. If they just decide to like rebuild, makes a lot of sense to me to go with Dariq, right? Seems reasonable.
No, I see that.
Is there anybody else? I mean, I guess you could say like Charlotte, maybe. I guess you could say Utah. They have multiple.
Yeah, I was
going
to say if he fell to Utah, I think that would be they need talent. So I think getting him would be a boon for them.
And wing talent, particularly. Yeah. I think wing talent would really help them quite a bit. I think that's really all. You wanted to talk about Kobe Bufkin. I don't know if you want to waste that much time talking about Kobe. We've been going
for
an hour.
Let's shift to another. Well, let's do that next pod. Let's talk about him.
Yeah, we'll talk about Kobe next podcast. Trying to think if there's anything else I need to get off my chest on the draft. I don't think so at this point. I will be podcasting tomorrow, though, with Andrew Schlecht.
Oh,
is
awesome.
Why.
That'll be fun to listen
I to. Am probably going to hold off until then. Andrew is going to take control of the podcast and literally just ask me questions for a while.
I love that.
And try and dive into some of these prospects. So we're going to do that tomorrow. That'll be the Thursday show. What day is it in the United States, Mark?
Well, it's Thursday now. But it'll be Thursday tomorrow, technically.
Yeah. So Schlecht will be here tomorrow. We're going to talk about that. Mark, tell the people where they can find your work. Tell the people what's going on.
You can find me on Twitter at @MG_Schindler. I have a Patreon. If you are an enjoyer of the basketball content that I put out and are willing to help support me while I search for making this full time. That is the best place to find me.
Mark's the best, folks. Go hit his Patreon, but go to The Athletic, subscribe. I will have the draft guide coming out, I think, next week at some point is the current date. I don't have an exact date. It will either. Yeah, I don't want to put a date on it yet because I don't want to put the pressure on the editors to get that whole thing done. It is next week.
Chopping block. Come on.
Not going to do it. Not going to do it to Tyler. Not going to do it to all of the great design people who helped me with this. But yeah, go to The Athletic. I will have stuff up the rest of the week. I had a thing on the Clippers earlier today. I'll have something on the Nets. I'll have something on Dariq, actually, because the Duke beat writer Brendan Marks actually asked me to talk about that a little bit. So I will have stuff coming up, and I will have a mock draft, I would guess, coming Monday, if you maybe put a date on it. Kind of trying to explain some of the intel that I've gotten and kind of understand to this point in the draft. Some of it gets released here. Some of it I try and save for The Athletic, trying to balance, you know, subscription site versus everything in front of the paywall with this thing. So, okay, folks, that's it. Until next time, we'll talk soon. Bye.